you know, I know that you've been studying mindfulness and practicing meditation for a long time. Was there an event in your life that led you towards learning about those things and seeking those tools? Or was it something that just kind of gradually over time, something that you found interest in and then you moved further and further into?
Absolutely. A couple events. One is, like you, I'm a meditator, but also a musician long before I was a meditator. So when I was in college, I had two passions. One was for jazz. I was going to potentially be a jazz piano player. And the other was for philosophy. And I remember making what I thought of at the time as the pragmatic decision to become a philosopher, because I thought that was a better career path, which is hilarious in retrospect. But anyway, I did end up getting a PhD in philosophy and teaching as a professor. At the end of my PhD program, so about 10 years into that whole process, two things happened. One was I was just starting to burn out. I mean, graduate school was so incredibly intense, sitting there in the library reading for 12 to 14 hours a day. The other is that I had a pretty serious bike accident. I ended up getting a pretty severe concussion and for the first time in my life experienced really intense anxiety and depression. And the combination of those two led me to this realization that even though I was reading all these amazing texts and I was asking these big questions as a philosopher, I wasn't actually gaining any tools for managing my own mind, right? Like, there was a way in which after all of this training, I had no clue how to manage the emotions and the thoughts that were swirling in my mind and the condition that I found myself in. So that was 2007, so a little over 15 years ago. And that was really the point where I started looking into things like meditation and yoga. And I realized, I think, in that moment that my primary passion in life was to explore philosophy as a mode of living rather than as a pathway to getting tenure or, you know, writing interesting articles for other professors. So that was kind of the moment for me.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And you touched on something that's really important, which is, like, so many people mistake knowledge for wisdom. You know, and you can read about all the ideas. And these days, of course, a lot of people just kind of read the Wikipedia entry. They read the first sentence that Google provides whenever they Google something. You know, so what I'm trying to say is that we all get a lot of kind of loose, light touch points on information. And then because we're aware of certain concepts or certain ideas, we then carry them in our minds as if they're wisdom, but really it's just information, right? So it's like information comes in whenever we become aware of something. And then once we compute it and think about it and strengthen our understanding of it, then it becomes knowledge. But then we have to actually wait until a moment in life happens where that knowledge intersects and we have to apply it with something we're experiencing in life before wisdom arises, right? So that's such an important part of the process of, you know, pursuing the inner path. And that's why a lot of people get frustrated, because they're like, well, I've been reading all these things. Why don't I, you know, why am I still suffering? And it's because of, you know, what you just described, which is, you know, not understanding how to turn that stuff into actual usable wisdom. So it's so cool that you had that as a part of your foundational experience.
Yeah, no. And I think that's a perspective we share. I was looking through Now is the Way, your book, recently, and it really struck me that it's very easy to talk about something like the present moment or being more aware of what's happening in our minds, or meta-aware is another word that comes up a lot, or phrase that comes up a lot. As theoretical concepts, these ideas are really kind of vacuous. Like, there's not much to them. You know, be in the present moment. What does that actually mean? Like, that's so, it's almost sounds like a bumper sticker or something Justin Bieber would tweet. You know, it's right. Just not very interesting. At the level of experience, though, and this is something I know you and I share, when you have that direct confrontation with the present moment or that direct contact with something that's at a level that's preconceptual, it's almost beneath all of our theories and understanding, it's so profound and can be life-changing to just have even a few moments where you're not totally lost in the grip of your wandering mind and you're kind of just here with whatever happens to be. Mm-hmm. So I love that distinction you're making between knowledge and wisdom. And I think you're right that knowledge is cheap. Information is cheap these days. I mean, we have access to all the information we want. We have AI, you know, we have ChatGPT, and yet there seems to be a real lack or scarcity of wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that's something I think about all the time where, and it's really useful to, it's easy to think about the kind of memification of mindfulness and, you know, wisdom, and to be critical of it and to be even frustrated by it. You know, I spend a lot of time being irritated because I'm like, you know, just posting something that's a picture with even, you know, be here now on it. Like, it's mm-hmm. cool, but like, there's so much more meat on the bone than that. We can do so much more than that. And it would frustrate me because I would worry that like people for who perhaps an inward pursuit is more of a peripheral, it's not like the focus of their life, but it's something that they think about now and again, that they think that that's all that there is like, okay, I should be here, you know, cool, I'll try and pay more attention or whatever that means, like you said. But there's so much opportunity, you know, if you really go beyond just kind of the simple words that define a lot of the, you know, general themes in the world. So yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. I'm curious, for you, you know, you have a new book called Open, which looks really great. And what was it? You know, I know that this book is about confronting some of this overwhelm of information and lack of depth head on. What was it that called to you that had you write this book?
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I started to notice that even though I had a pretty serious practice of meditation and yoga, I was experiencing this feeling of my mind getting smaller. Like my mind was kind of closing down. And what I mean by that is that I would feel some sort of discomfort or emotional unease. And I could feel this like instantaneous craving inside of me at the deepest level toward pulling out my phone or toward going on a news site and experiencing some quick hit of political outrage. And I started to realize at a certain point that I wasn't the only one having this experience, that there was something bigger happening here, that perhaps this is really the problem of our time. Because I think, you know, if you listen to a lot of conversations these days, you'll hear people talking about they feel stressed, they feel distracted, they feel overwhelmed. And you'll often hear people talking about some sort of other that they have a lot of like really critical negative judgments about. So maybe that's a family member, maybe that's the opposite political candidate that they hate. But underneath all of that, there's this subtle experience of turning away from instead of turning toward life. And that's kind of why I think this is the problem of our time, because this experience is ubiquitous. I think we're all aware that it's happening on some level, but it's usually invisible. It's usually happening beneath the radar of awareness. So just feeling that in myself, I started to realize, you know, it would be really interesting to explore some of these forces of closure more deeply. So one thing I did is spend about 3 days just binging on my screen because I wanted to understand, like, if we go all the way in to closure, what is that like? So I wanted to understand closure, but then I also wanted to understand like, okay, well, if we want to create more space in the mind, which again is an idea, that's such an ethereal kind of abstract thing, but if we want to actually feel that, experience more space, what are the tools and practices we can use to get us there?
Yeah, I really love the like putting yourself in the driver's seat and really experimenting. I mean, that's so cool, man. And it's true is that like I really notice, and I'm sure you do too, just kind of on a day-to-day basis, like how much time you spend, you know, kind of with your nose down, stuck in algorithm land versus not, like how that correlates to your level of awareness and just general sort of spaciousness of mind. It's like, I totally notice that as well. And it's fascinating where, just like you were describing, like I notice, you know, as someone that's meditated for 25 years, I notice that just the gentle compression of my attention span, of my patience, of my interest, like how long I'll look at something, you know, it's all shorter than it was in a lot of different areas. And then of course, in some areas it's actually unaffected or it's gone the other direction. But in that sort of like task day to day, like holding your attention on something like that, I notice it has changed. And, one thing that's kind of interesting is that I do wonder if it's just a matter of like devaluing as well. It's like we're if we have so much information coming at us, it doesn't feel as precious as perhaps it once did. So we sort of devalue it as well as have our attention pulled away. What did that feel like for you, just drilling down further into your experiment? I'd love for if you could just describe the two polarities of like intense constriction versus intense openness.
Yeah, well, let's start with the closure side of the polarity. So as I was alluding to, I had tried all of these screen time strategies and hacks, you know, that you're supposed to use to like use your phone less. And some of them worked, but for the most part, they didn't get to the core craving that I was still feeling, even when I was using all these things. So I started to wonder, well, what would happen if instead of trying to abstain or restrain myself from my screen, I just allowed myself to go all in, to binge on like this buffet of digital treats. And my inspiration was really from the Buddhist tradition. You know, in Tantric Buddhism, there's this whole idea of feast practice where instead of abstaining from things like sex or decadent eating or drinking, the idea is that if we go into these states, if we sort of overindulge consciously, maybe we can begin to burn out some of the roots of these cravings and desires. So I figured, wouldn't it be interesting to test that with screens, right? Mm-hmm. Like the tantric Buddhists weren't like on Instagram, but we are. So let's see what happens. Yeah, I spent 3 days, all day, every day doing this. And I learned a few things. One, it was really interesting. You know, there's a lot of talk about why everybody has insomnia right now and sleep is so difficult. Well, just being on screens completely wrecked my sleep. Every night I was up at like 2:40 a.m. just wired. So that was one thing I noticed. The main thing I noticed, though, is that in a paradoxical way, this overindulgence actually worked, in the sense that after the experiment, I woke up and I had the thought, like, this is where I usually grab my phone and I go to the bathroom and, you know, get on my email and all sorts of other things. And the desire just completely fell flat. And I started to realize that the reason for that, and the reason I'm so addicted, I think we all are so addicted to screens, is that we have this experience of novelty. You know, that like when you open up your phone, there's new information in your text, there's new information in your email, there's a new feed on Instagram or Facebook, there's a new set of stories on your favorite news site. And so by going all the way with my phone, I was able to, in a sense, destroy its superpower. Like I had seen everything there was to see. There's nothing left to give me that experience of novelty. And, right. And so that, I think, was a really interesting just experience. Again, like, you know, there's sort of information about the problems that arise through screens, but I wanted to experience like what happens when we go way deep into it and have that in my own nervous system and body. So that was kind of my dive into the side of the closure polarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I sounds to me like you sort of just wrung out every last drop of like dopamine that you had. And so,
exactly.
You know what I mean? So whenever you would engage back in those things again, and it was trying to hit the button, it was like, no, there's none left, man. I'm not feeling anything from this anymore. You know, but you really raise a good point for it. Is like, most of it comes down to that craving desire response, you know, where like we crave the novelty of, as you said, like, you know, what's new information I can look up? What's a new distraction? What's something else that has to do with me? Will I get an email, like something good that, you know, whatever. And it's fascinating that if you look at the brain chemistry of addiction, you know, you'll see that it's not the actual acquiring of whatever the addicted substance is that releases dopamine. It's actually the state in between the like arousal created by desire and the moment right before actually acquiring the thing that we desire, where the brain chemicals are released. And that's what creates the cycle of addiction. It's because we you know, actually getting the thing isn't really satisfying it. It's like the movement towards it. So that's why it's so difficult, you know, and like, of course, technology, it's like, there's no, what greater thing, like, show me a more powerful tractor beam than, you know, all the buffet of things that technology can offer. So after you did that, and also you mentioned, you know, this thinking of this is in the sense of a tantric Buddha practice, which I think is fantastic. And in case people aren't aware, that was one of the experiments that Buddha did in terms of food, was the ascetic, you know, approach and the overindulgent approach of like eating a lot of food to see like, what does this do to the stability of my mind? And then starving himself to where he was almost, you know, like losing consciousness. And he's like, what does this do to my suffering? Does this kill suffering? Like, if I have nothing, he's like, well, that doesn't work. And that's, of course, where the middle way comes from, is he was like, okay, it's right in the middle. Like, find balance between those two things, find balance and everything. Okay, so just moving on. So now after you rang out all of your serotonin and dopamine, whenever you flipped it and you went to what I'm imagining is just a dry period. What was that like for your mind?
Yeah. Well, I love that you brought up the Buddha and the aesthetic side and the overindulgence side. I think that pairing those two together is actually a really powerful practice in and of itself. So going way into the overindulgence side of something like screens, but then having a dopamine fast where you abstain from screens. And both of those are powerful because they're not our ordinary habituated reality, right? Like when we're overindulging, we're experiencing something very different that's a shock to the system. When we're underindulging or fasting, we're experiencing another shock to the system. So I think like pairing those two together, just leaning into one or the other, can be really powerful because at its essence, I think what we're doing there is just giving our habit system this huge, massive, disruptive shock so that we can figure out where do we want to reset it? And to your point, how do we find the middle way? Like, what does the middle way look like for us? So for me, that practice was really powerful in that it did leave me with this experience of diminished craving that I just didn't have as much craving for my screen. Now, I will say that shift wasn't permanent. So it was probably, you know, a month or 2 months, maybe even 3 months where I could really feel this sort of transformed dopamine system, you know, this almost revulsion to my device, but eventually it would come back. And so I think, you know, these kinds of tactics are really interesting for understanding closing, but we do need to have certain tactics where we're modifying our environment such that these cravings we have for our screens and political outrage aren't so powerful. Really, though, I think that led me to the idea that it's not enough to just figure out how we keep ourselves away from these cravings. We have to also think about like, how do we open to the states in our mind that almost fuel these cravings in the first place? And what I mean by that is, I think if you look at most forms of addiction, usually there's some unprocessed, uncomfortable, challenging set of emotions or mind states that are going on that are so uncomfortable, we want to sort of get ourselves out of that experience. We want to somehow distract ourselves from that experience. And I think this bears true in the research on phone addiction that, yeah, to a certain extent, it's an addiction to dopamine, but it's also a form of resistance or sort of checking out from some of these more traumatic, challenging mind states that we might have. So if we really want to upend these cravings, I think we have to go one level deeper and look at, like, how do we open to some of this emotional, psychological material that's quite challenging? And really that, I think, becomes the key to unwinding some of these cravings.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's like all of that stuff comes from essentially just denial, you know, and that's why distraction is distraction. It's like you're not just distracting your attention away from the present, you're distracting it away from what's happening inside of you as well. I mean, that's the real reason why people love distraction so much. You know, it's like, well, you're not just bored. It's like you're distracting because on a subconscious or like a deeper level, you're in some type of emotional pain, or you're refusing to confront something on an intellectual level. And if you keep your focus embroiled in kind of nonsense, then you aren't forced to look at whatever it is that's actually causing you discomfort, as you said. That's why some of this, you know, more extreme experiments can be interesting. If you go, that's like why people, they're like, I did a 10-day silent meditation retreat and I was like crying my eyes out from day two totally. Until day eight or whatever. And it's because it was, you know, all of the noise and fog was washed away and they were left to look at what was actually causing them pain. And then we're able to start processing a little bit. I'm curious, what are some of the tools and methods that you put in the book to help people find that balance and to ultimately just kind of claim more ownership over their attention and what they're feeling and experiencing?
Yeah, I love everything you're saying there. And in terms of the tools, there are a variety of them. So things like meditation, what I would call street opening or street meditation, where we bring it into the chaos of everyday life. Psychedelic assisted therapy is something I was very fascinated by. Wasn't actually planning to do in the context of this book, but ended up being really interesting. Opening to our political adversaries and political enemies, another really interesting piece. So maybe we can drop into the simplest place to go first would be meditation, because I know that that's where you and I spend a lot of time practicing and thinking about that as a practice. And to your point about the Vipassana retreat, of like, what is it that happens in the mind when you spend 10 days not talking, not making eye contact, just practicing in silence, following the breath or doing a body scan or whatever it is that you're doing. And I think, you know, you described this. I've had the same experience on silent retreats where it's like what happens for me anyway is for a day or two, it's amazing. And I feel so relieved not to have to check my email and watch the news. And then the novelty of that wears off. And it's like all of a sudden things get so freaking intense. And all these like thoughts and emotions that I don't really have to feel in the context of ordinary life, because I have all these like really clever distraction tools that I've created, they all just arise. And so, a practice like meditation, I think, is so powerful when it comes to creating space in the mind and opening, because really, like, I love the teacher Pema Chodron and her whole idea that in essence, all we're doing is just training our ability to stay rather than run away, to just stay. Like, anxiety comes up, stay. Anger comes up, stay. Really extreme, crazy thoughts come up, stay. And that is not pleasurable in the way that going on Instagram is pleasurable, but it does, at least for me, create this practice or this way of being in the world where my mind is able to now include such a wider, vaster array of states and feelings and emotions and thoughts. And ultimately, I think the benefit of that is freedom. Because when we're in that state where we're trying to like run away from everything and we don't want to feel or whatever it is, like that's a really constrained state. I mean, there's a way in which we don't have a whole lot of freedom. The playing field is small, but the playing field gets way bigger with meditation, as I know you've been experiencing in your life as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's great, a great approach to those things. And you know, I find that is such a powerful practice as well. Whenever you feel a frustration, you feel an anger, you feel a sadness, you feel a desire, whatever it is, just being present with it, you know, because it feels destabilizing initially, because those greater states, the more intense states of feeling like that, are rare. So we don't have as much practice with them. Because if you look at our kind of day to day, like life is pretty boring. Like we're just sort of going along. We're not really feeling too much. We're not really in these like peak states, something that would be, you know, like something that would be, you know, really impactful to us. So whenever we feel it, it's kind of white hot because we're just unfamiliar with that feeling. And so that's, of course, why it's uncomfortable and people react and then they go to do whatever they do to numb that feeling or escape that feeling. But I find what's rather fascinating is that nothing actually brings you closer to the present than some of those feelings. And it's because like, but it's just like this flash of light, you know, where, and if you sit in it, it can become really powerful. It's because you are forced to look inward for a flash of a moment because you're feeling this feeling. And you normally don't look inward with that same level of intensity because you don't need to. But whenever we're like, oh, I'm feeling this way and I want to react and get out of it. But if you can just be present with it, the weight and the intensity and the scariness of that feeling goes away like really quickly if you can just hang in there for a minute. And then you get the, if you can do that, then it ceases to become scary and it starts to become a practice, you know? And so then when you have one of those peak feelings, you can look at it and go, okay, like this is uncomfortable, but it's no big deal. What am I feeling in this moment and why? You know, and that's, of course, how you unweave the conditioned patterns of the things in life that are causing you suffering. You know, it's amazing how it works.
Yeah, what I love about what you're saying there is like this idea that some of those uncomfortable states are actually this source of profound vitality and aliveness. I mean, that's really true for me. Like something like anxiety, yes, it's uncomfortable. I don't prefer to experience that if compared to like feeling calm or feeling really, you know, blissful or whatever it is. And yet, to your point, like if you actually ride that anxiety and like watch the sensations happening in your body, it is so alive and so energized and so potent. Like the energy there is really incredible. And I think one of the other barriers here is this idea that I've been playing around with a lot recently and I've been playing around with in the book as well, that in a way, like we live in a culture where the center of gravity is really focused around this experience of feeling good. You know, if you go on social media, Instagram, it's all kind of about like, ways to feel good. And, you know, there's all this like podcasting culture about how to feel great all the time by like working out and intermittent fasting and all these different things. And on some level, that's fine. But there's a subconscious message there, which is something like the following: feeling happy and, you know, pleasurable. That's good. We want that. Anything other than that is bad. We want to get rid of that. So anxiety, bad. Fear, bad. Nervousness, bad. Anger, bad, right? So we're Xing out like half of the human experience through that dichotomy. And that's where I've just found myself falling into so much trouble in my own practice, because at a deep and subconscious level, there's this part of me that always wants to get back to happy land. Like, I just want to feel good. You know, like that's what they're talking about on Instagram. Why can't I just feel good? And so the practice for me, and I think for all of us at some level, is practicing being okay with not feeling good.
Yeah, no, I totally feel you on that. And I mean, like, honestly, not feeling good is so much more interesting than feeling good.
But that's crazy to say, like, not feeling good is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, like, either of those things, feeling blissful or relaxed, old, I guess for me, it just not being inconvenienced, not being bothered, you know, not having to put forth some type of resistance towards the world, versus feeling bad. Like, they're both just kind of the same, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm just observing them from a witness state of mind and navigating through, like, what they're presenting in the moment and why they're arising. And they're both kind of just, yeah, they're both just really fascinating, and they're both just worthy of exploration. You know, it's like, whenever I'm feeling good, I explore that too. You know, maybe it's just a kind of inexhaustible curiosity, but like, if I'm feeling really good, I'll be like, it's so funny how I'll just observe my decision-making. You know, like, how that changes, how I'll say yes to things that I would normally say no to, how I'll be, you know, maybe I'm more generous with my time, maybe I'm doing, you know, whatever the thing is. I'm like, huh, it's so weird that because the chemicals in my body are flowing in a way in which, you know, I've applied a label that is supposed to mean positive, you know, that now my behavioral patterns have shifted to meet that. And then conversely, whenever I'm feeling, you know, irritated or tired or something like that, the same thing happens. It's just, yeah, it's just fascinating, but they're really kind of the same thing if you look at it from the right vantage point.
Well, so I'm always curious, because I feel like I'm constantly learning in this space. You know, when we started our conversation today, you were telling me you are not feeling good, like you're having an allergy thing that's happening. For you, what are the tools you use? Like, what's your practice in moments like this? Because I imagine you're actually practicing this in real time on some level.
Right. Yeah. So basically, just to fill in. So if you're in Austin or you've been here, Cedar Fever is real. It's a thing. It kind of, it's fascinating is that it makes your mind like really hazy, and it makes it hard to concentrate. It's just a type of allergies that has a very interesting effect. I've had friends that have moved here and they're like, I feel like I'm almost like hungover or something, but I didn't drink. And I'm like, yeah, welcome to the Cedar Fever land of Austin. So there's like these rolling hills west of Austin that are nothing but cedar trees. And when they release the pollen, it just like covers, blows through the city and destroys everyone. Anyway, so yeah, that's a really good question. So in a moment like now, what I would do and what I've been doing throughout this conversation is I'm aware that my mind is less sharp and less present than it naturally is or normally is. And so the practice for me is creating enough space and pacing my conversation, like my side of the conversation, in a way that gives me time to then take like a second look at what I'm saying as I'm saying it, so that I can make sure that like I'm speaking from a grounded and well-intentioned place. So normally my language is running through a mindfulness filter in terms of like in daily life, whenever I'm talking, I'm aware of what I'm saying as I'm saying it. And about 95% of the time, I'm intricately choosing what I'm expressing, like with complete intention. I like that I just stammered intention. And so, you know, obviously that allows me to express myself in a non-conditioned way, and therefore with as much clarity and as much connection to who I want to be in that moment, as opposed to a reactionary version of myself or a mindless version of myself. However, I've done that for so long that it just occurs quite naturally. It's just an effortless process. It's just how I am, these days. In this moment, because of the allergy situation, that is occurring, but then it's basically, there's like a second module of that plugged on to, so it's like an effects pedal on a guitar. So it's like I plugged in another box of that. So I'm talking, I'm aware of what I'm saying as I'm saying it, but I've changed the pace so that I have time to then kind of take a second look at how I'm expressing myself so that I can make sure that I'm making sense and that I am meeting you at an appropriate place in the conversation.
Well, for what it's worth, I am actually really enjoying the slower pace. I don't know if our listeners are having the same experience, but I go on a lot of podcasts and sometimes there is a pace that is so fast and so frenetic that it changes my own experience,
right,
as someone who's talking, that I go into these kind of set pieces in my brain that I have, you know, like practice talking points.
Yeah.
And instead of playing jazz, all of a sudden I'm playing some sort of classical music where I'm trying to follow this like prearranged score.
Yeah. You're going into your act.
So anyway, what I appreciate is that something bad, unpleasant is going on over there. And yet you're working with it. We're working with it together to allow that to be, and to actually like see what happens out of the ground of this like bad, uncomfortable thing, which might be more beautiful than the thing that would have been better. You know, it's, absolutely. I mean, these are the paradoxes of meditation and this whole practice that I think are so fascinating, that the challenging negative states we push away are often the most powerful, help us grow, you know, help us be more fully who we are, even though we don't want to experience them.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Yeah, I mean, it's all just, you know, like, it's all up to your level of openness and curiosity and ability to just engage what is, you know, because there's the profound nature it's in everything, you know, like every experience, every good, bad, pleasant, unpleasant, clear, foggy, it's always there. It's just, are you doing the work and opening your mind enough to see that and to then download and kind of learn from each of those moments? So moving back into some of the information in your book, I'm very curious how this talking to your political adversaries experiment went for you.
Yeah, well, the context here is I live in Boulder, Colorado, which is a very liberal town. I am in favor of things like gun control. I have a fear of guns, to be honest. And so as I was engaging in this project of learning how to open more, what are the practices and tools we can use? I realized part of this is internal tools like meditation, psychedelic assisted therapy, where we're opening to our own mind. But part of it, especially now, has something to do with opening at a more external level. And right now feels like, you know, in an unprecedented way, we're closing down to other people more than at any other time in history. So there's actually really interesting research from Gallup. 1980, about 47% of Americans felt warm and favorable toward the other political party. In 2020, that number goes down almost in half to 25%. So we're increasingly polarized and increasingly suspicious of each other. And one of the things I wanted to do was put myself in a situation where I was just fully immersed in a group that had a completely and radically different perspective. And it was actually quite difficult living in a place like Boulder that's this kind of like enclave of people who all think alike. So I ended up finding out that the National Rifle Association, the NRA, does these courses, which are trainings for getting your concealed carry permit. And so I ended up doing this and going to rural Colorado. And just one story that kind of illustrates the paradoxes of this practice. I decided in advance that I was going to wear my Denver Bronco hat. That's our state's football team, thinking that, you know, maybe we can't agree on politics, but we're all Bronco fans, right? We all live in Colorado. Everybody can agree on that. So I walk in and there's this woman there who's in the class who has a Kansas City Chiefs jacket. And I'm like, oh, Chiefs, like, not sure if we can be friends. I'm a Bronco fan, you know, just a little joke. And her husband comes up to me and is like, oh, you don't have to worry about that at all. We haven't watched the NFL in 5 years after the kneeling. And I'm like, the kneeling? Oh, Black Lives Matter. And then the instructor overhears us and he's like, yeah, I haven't given the NFL a cent of my money in 5 years because of the kneeling. So I then go to the bathroom, come back out. The instructor and this other gentleman are talking and, you know, I overhear them saying, well, I just think the right conservative party has all the best answers. And then he says, but maybe we shouldn't assume things. Turns around, points at me and he's like, what side are you on? So I had this crazy moment where I'm like, well, how do you respond to that question? So I told him what was true for me in the moment. I was like, I'm on the side of being open to all points of view if I can. And I thought that there was going to be another one of these like, oh, how could you believe that? But the opposite happened. Like everybody's face lit up and everybody's like, yeah, that's exactly what we need. We need more of that. We need more people talking to each other. Why can't we talk to each other anymore? And so for me, like that was this crazy moment where I realized that we can't agree on anything. We can't even agree on a shared interest for a modern gladiator sport, but we can agree that we should be more open and we should actually talk to each other. So for me, the big realization was that once we're face to face, once we're actually talking to the people who we think are the enemy, it's like, I had this experience of realizing there is no enemy there. Like we're living in these siloed media chambers where it seems like these people are against us and they're against America and all these things, but we're all kind of trying our best. And so that was a real liberation for me. And my hope is, especially in an election year like this, 2024, that practice can help us at least kind of like see the humanity in the other side.
Yeah, that's a beautiful sentiment. Absolutely. And it's also like, It just sounds like a cartoon, like what you were talking about. Like, I can't imagine being in a situation where someone's like, what side are you on, stranger? You know what I mean? That's never happened.
It was very cartoonish. Yes.
I think that if I was in a public situation and that conversation arose and then someone looked at me and pointed and was like, what side are you on? I would just start laughing so hard. I'd be like, what universe is this where that's the but... it's wonderful to hear that you navigated as you did. It'd be curious to take that practice to somewhere like the Westboro Baptist Church people or something like that. You know, really, really get in there and see how, you know, really run that one through a very challenging filter. But you never know, you know, you never know how, I feel like that in my experience, in terms of being open, it has an unbelievable effect, you know, but someone has to be the one to set the playing field. And it sounds like you did that in that moment, you know, at the NRA meeting or training rather. Good.
Yeah. And I was just going to say that you're pointing to something that I think is so essential, which is our mind states are contagious at a very subtle level. So if we go into a situation where we're talking to somebody who disagrees with us and our mind state is one of, I'm going to persuade this person, I'm going to win the debate, I'm going to show them they're an idiot, that they're believing all sorts of misinformation, right? Like that mind state is subtly contagious and they're going to approach us with exactly the same state of mind. And this is where I think the power of practicing to approach life and approach others with a more open mind is incredible, because like that state is contagious too. To your point, like when you enter any sort of a conversation with your spouse or a friend or somebody you disagree with, but you come from that place of curiosity and openness, they might still have a lot of defensiveness, but at a certain point, it's like they just let it go and they open too, because there's something about that mind state that's really contagious. So I think that's, I try to remind myself of that as being one of reasons for doing this practice. It's not just for me and my own mind. It's that I want to have my own mind have these ripple effects on other people. And wouldn't that be amazing if we could be just a little bit more open? You know, even if it's just one person, one at a time, that still has a pretty profound effect on the world.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I don't think it's subtly contagious. I think it's very, very intensely contagious, you know? Someone could look at that, you know, that could be a difficult example, you know, if someone can't really relate to it. But if you look at it in other areas of life, like you think about, you have that one friend that you meet up with that you just instantly are just like laughing within 2 minutes of being together. And that's just what you do like all night. You're just joking, you're laughing, you know, and it's like it's. But then you go, there's this other friend that you meet up with and you have these kind of deeper, you know, more maybe meaningful or emotional conversations with. And it's like, but like, why was that person the laugh person and the other person is the, you know, emotional person? It's like, but it's crazy how just it's such a night and day of like what's coming out of you and like not only the energy, but also just the whole worldview, you know, how you feel and like what part of yourself that you access. To me, I love what you're saying. And I actively practice, you know, that in every interaction I have. And again, it's become a thing that's just automatic, I suppose. But I discovered, you know, quite some time ago that like, if you engage with someone and you just let go, of the all of the stuff about the human game, you let go of all of the stuff about like any of the thoughts that are rising in your own mind, like, oh, are they judging me? Do they like me? Do I sound like an idiot? Like all the things that I'm anxious, like all the things that people think, all the intrusive thoughts that run through their minds, just like let all of this go and keep coming back to the present moment, keep relaxing the body, and then speak from a place of genuine, like authentic truth, not in the terms of like, you know, like telling them your truth, but just, you know, say what you feel, be honest, be, you know, open and be comfortable, you know, and be genuine. And it's crazy how whenever you do that, the other person can feel that coming through and they're like, oh, this person is actually talking to me, not their idea of me. This person is being non-judgmental and present and open, and they're really like letting me in. That gives me the opportunity to be able to do the same thing, you know? And it's crazy is that from observing doing this for so long, it's like people are dying to speak from that place, you know, because they don't really get the opportunity to. They don't engage with someone who they feel is just calm and comfortable and non-judgmental and paying attention to them, you know? And so whenever you give someone that opportunity, they're like, oh my God, let me please have a deep, rich, genuine connection here for a moment. And it's just an incredible thing because you just sweep away all of that nonsense of the human game and you actually get to something real, really fast.
I love that. I think you're absolutely right. There's such a scarcity of authenticity in our culture right now. And I think so many of us spend so much of our time just trying to put on this facade of almost inhumanity where it's like, we've got our shit together. We're really successful. We do all the workouts. We take the right supplements. We listen to the right influencers or whatever. And it's exhausting. And it's exhausting when I'm around that kind of energy, because then I there's this subtle part of me that's trying to like bring up my own, you know, perfection and see if I can match that. So I love the idea of like, hey, what if we all just acknowledge we're kind of like screwed up, messed up humans doing the best we can, trying our best. And it's hard. And sometimes we don't do it right. Like that's such a more friendly place to live from, such a more creative place where mistakes are okay, you know, and being vulnerable is okay. And not having our shit together is okay.
Yeah, 100%, man. Yeah, it's like we're all just terrified and confused monkeys, you know, flying exactly. in the middle of infinity, who are incredibly totally. Self-enamored. I mean, that's like,
yes,
I'm so addicted to obsessing over my own confusion and fear, you know. But that's how we're designed, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, Nate, thanks for coming on the podcast. And for the book, I'm excited for that to get out there and to help people. I think that it's something that everyone needs, you know, and just as a support to help people kind of get back to themselves and get out of that state of closure, you know, and get back to a more open place. So thank you. And yeah, man, thank you for being you.
Thank you, Corey. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the work you do. And just for creating the space for us to have a conversation like this. I feel like it's a real gift to have this kind of a space. So thank you for that.
Beautiful. Yeah, you got it, man.